Okay, well, good evening, everyone. This is Ray Giannini. We will be wrapping up in Genesis 49 as well as Genesis 50, finishing the book on this long but really fruitful study in the book of Genesis. Today, I wanted to make my comments about Genesis 49 and 50 and then conclude with one of the Bible Project's video that summarizes Genesis 12 through 50, that portion dealing starting with Abraham and then taking us all the way through Joseph. So let's look at what we have in Genesis 49 tonight. I'd like to share screen, if I could, Neil.
Yeah.
Okay, no problem. How about those Bucks, huh? That was an exciting game six. Wow, that was really, really fun to watch. So
yeah.
65,000 fans outside.
Be good now, Ray, I think.
Okay, great. So we have, here it is. So let's begin then taking a look at our presentation. I'm not sure why it's not rolling forward here. There we go. So tonight's, if you recall that last time we covered Jacob's last words to his sons, verses 1 through 28. Tonight we'll be looking at Genesis 49, 20, verses 29 through 33, Jacob's burial instructions repeated, and then we'll go into Genesis 50. So before Jacob departed, as he lay dying, Jacob once more made a request that his sons bury him in the land of promise with his fathers. We find this in verse 29. And the specific place he had in mind was Machpelah, verse 30. So let's read these verses together here. Jacob's death and burial. I have the New King James Version. It says, verse 29, then he charged them and said to them, I am to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave that is in the field of Machpelah, which is before Mamre or Mamre in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought with the field of Ephron the Hittite as a possession for the burial place. There they buried Abraham and Sarah, his wife, and they buried Isaac and Rebekah, his wife, and there I buried Leah. The field and the cave that is there were purchased from the sons of Heth. Verse 33, and when Jacob had finished commanding his sons, he drew his feet up into the bed and breathed his last and was gathered to his people. So as he lay dying, as I mentioned, Jacob once more made a request that his sons bury him in the land of promise with his fathers. The specific place he had in mind was Machpelah. You'll remember that the burial place was purchased by Abraham in chapter 23. Abraham was very specific about this parcel of land, thinking about future generations and what was going to happen. Although Jacob had made a similar request in Genesis 47, now this becomes much more specific. He wanted to be buried in the land with Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, Rebekah, and Leah. So Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, these are the central figures in this continuing narrative. The point of Jacob's request within the present narrative is to refresh our awareness of the promise of the land that was made, the covenant, the promise that Jacob's seed would live in peace in the land promised to Abraham and Isaac. So we have the Abrahamic covenant. Spiritual progeny that would be greater than the sand of the sea, the stars of the sky. The second covenant is the Palestinian covenant, a specific parcel of land given to Israel. Then we have the third covenant, the Davidic covenant, that someone from the line of David would always rule. As we looked at last time, we found out that was from the tribe of Judah, the royal line, royal tribe. And then finally, the new covenant. These, as the King James says, are promises that are not to be repented of. The New King James says that these are promises that are irrefutable. God made the promise. He's not going to take these back. What's interesting about these promises is, for instance, Dave Dunlop in his book, several of his books, he talks about these covenant promises. And I just throw out David Dunlop because he's well known in the assemblies. There are many, many other writers that have talked about this, but he made a particular point that was very interesting. He said, when Augustine and other early church fathers looked behind them, they saw Israel that was destroyed, people that were scattered. And they looked at these covenants that were given by God that, again, were not ever to be taken back by God. And they thought, where can we apply them? And so for the reform mindset, it was, we're going to apply these to the church. But our dispensational view is that these are promises that were made to Israel. We're in a time now where Israel has been placed on the shelf, so to speak, during this age of grace. And then God will resume his plan for Israel, starting with the tribulation period and ending in the millennial kingdom. This is what Israelites were looking forward to, this time of unbridled blessing, peace, where holiness, as Ezekiel said, will be as common as plates and cups and saucers. We look at a world today that profanity or things that are made, things that are holy being made profane is common. But in the millennial kingdom, that will be the reverse, where God will rule with an iron fist and holiness will be the standard. And so this is one of these covenants here. We go back to Hebrews 11, verse 21, a verse we read last time. It was by faith that Jacob, when he was old and dying, blessed each of Joseph's sons and bowed in worship as he leaned on his staff. The point here is to show that Jacob's faith in God's promises remained firm to the end. He lives one of the most fascinating lives to look at it with respect to spiritual lessons and case studies about an individual. But the bottom line is he remained faithful to the end. And with such an expression of faith still on his lips, the Bible wraps up this well-spoken remark. He breathed his last and was gathered to his people. Verse 33, Genesis 49. So we're going to roll then to Genesis 50. This can be outlined in three ways. Verses 1 through 14, Jacob's death and burial. Verses 15 through 21, Joseph's forgiveness. And then finally, verses 22 through 26, a summary of Joseph's life and death. Remember that the writer, Moses, some commentators call him the writer, but Moses, as he's summing these things up, he wants the Israelites to understand where they came from and what they have, these promises, very much what Paul talks about in Romans 3. They had the oracles of God. They had the tabernacle, the garments. They had all of these things that were precious and special to them. And in this particular case, they have a heritage, a progeny here, a spiritual family that is unique and separated to the purposes of God. So verses 1 through 14, Jacob's death and burial. Over half of the final chapter is occupied with the description of the mourning and burial of Jacob. And so when you look at the portion, you would say, well, there may not be a lot here, but there actually is quite a bit here. Notice that Joseph himself mourns for his father, and then the Egyptians also mourn. Verse 3, great preparations were made both by Joseph and the Egyptians. And so let's read Genesis 50 here. As we think about some of these things here. So Genesis 50, starting in verse 1, says, and I have the New King James again, then Joseph fell on his father's face and wept over him and kissed him. Verse 2, and Joseph commanded his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father. So the physicians embalmed Israel. 40 days were required for him, for such are the days required for those who are embalmed, and the Egyptians mourned for him 70 days. Verse 4, now when the days of his mourning were past, Joseph spoke to the household of Pharaoh, saying, if now I have found favor in your eyes, please speak in the hearing of Pharaoh, saying, verse 5, my father made me swear, saying, behold, I am dying. In my grave, which I dug for myself in the land of Canaan, there you shall bury me. Now, therefore, please let me go up and bury my father, and I will come back. Verse 6, and Pharaoh said, go up and bury your father, as he made you swear. So Joseph went up to bury his father, and with him went up all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his house, and all the elders of the land of Egypt. Verse 8, as well as all the house of Joseph, his brothers, and his father's house. Only their little ones, their flocks, and their herds they left in the land of Goshen. Remember, it's that rich land of Goshen. And there went up with him both chariots and horsemen, and it was a great, very great gathering. Verse 10, then they came to the threshing floor of Atad, which is beyond the Jordan, and they mourned there with a great and very solemn lamentation. He observed 7 days of mourning for his father, and when the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, saw the mourning at the threshing floor of Atad, they said, this is deep mourning of the Egyptians. Therefore, its name shall be called Abel Mizraim, which is beyond the Jordan. Verse 12, then his sons did for him just as he had commanded them, for his sons carried him to the land of Canaan and buried him in the cave of the field of Machpelah before Mamre, which Abraham bought with the field from Ephron the Hittite as property for a burial place. And after he had buried his father, Joseph returned to Egypt, he and his brothers and all who went up with him to bury his father. So great preparations were made by both Joseph and the Egyptians. A special request was granted by Pharaoh to bury Jacob in his homeland. And a large, the NIV here says, a very large company was provided by Pharaoh as a burial procession to carry Jacob's body back to Canaan. We see God's hand here all over. All Pharaoh's officials and all the dignitaries of Egypt, along with Pharaoh's chariots and horsemen, accompanied Joseph on his journey back to Canaan. Even the Canaanites recognize this as a very large or heavy, solemn ceremony of mourning. They were moved by this. And Moses, the writer himself, seems to go out of his way to emphasize in detail the magnitude of the ceremony of mourning. So here's the question. Why does Genesis devote this much detail over the burial of Jacob? And the death of the other patriarchs, we just really don't have very much said. In fact, even in Genesis 50, when it comes to Joseph, very little is said. Why does Genesis devote this much detail over the burial of Jacob? Consider the account, as I mentioned, the death of Joseph. It consists of just a brief notice that he died and was embalmed and entombed in verse 26. Was his burial any less significant than Jacob's? And the answer is no. But almost no attention in narrative is devoted to it. Why then the emphasis on Jacob's burial? One commentator states that what immediately comes to mind is that at a number of points throughout the narrative, that the writer's concern focuses on God's faithfulness to his promise of the land and the hope of God's people in the eventual return to the land. And this is interesting because, you know, so much of the Old Testament, I mean, all of it is really devoted to this earthly kingdom, this time of blessing. We see, you know, pronouncements made in the immediacy of when it's written about countries that existed at that time. We have looks back to what the Israelites possessed, but also this look forward, sometimes in the same verse, past, present, future. If you're reading Isaiah, for instance. And they've been promised this time of blessing, this time of where Israel will be the center of the world and such. And so in later prophetic literature, a recurring image of the fulfillment of this promise to return to the land pictures Israel returning to the land, accompanied by many from among the nations. The prophets of Israel saw the return as a time when all the nations will stream to Jerusalem. And many peoples will come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. Zechariah saw it. In those days, 10 men from all languages and nations will take firm hold of one Jew by the hem of his robe and say, let us go with you. They're that excited to learn. It's that prominent. It's that important. And it's difficult not to see the same imagery at work in the present narrative. Jacob and his final return to the land of promise was accompanied by a great congregation of the officials and elders of the land of Egypt. These are pagans, and they're honoring Jacob. As we saw last time, there were two significant meetings. Jacob meets Pharaoh and blesses him, but Pharaoh meets Jacob and honors him. So with him also was the mighty army of the Egyptians, the greatest superpower at that time. So that's the story of Jacob's burial in the land, foreshadows the time when God will bring Jacob back from captivity and will have compassion on all the people of Israel, as Ezekiel says, Ezekiel 39, verse 25. So let's take a look at this second section of the outline of Genesis 50. This is verses 15 through 21. We have Joseph's forgiveness. Again, Joseph, just an extraordinary and very special man, gifted with so many graces of the Lord. So the narrative turns once more to the scene of Joseph and his brothers. And let's take a look at these verses here, verses 15 through 21. It says, when Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, perhaps Joseph will hate us and may actually repay us for all the evil which we did to him. So they sent messengers to Joseph saying, before your father died, he commanded saying, thus you shall say to Joseph, I beg you, please forgive the trespass of your brothers and their sin, for they did evil to you. Now, please forgive the trespasses of the servants of the God of your father. And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. Then his brothers also went and fell down before his face, and they said, behold, we are your servants. Joseph said to them, do not be afraid, for am I in the place of God? But as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, in order to bring it about as it is to this day, to save many people alive. Now, therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones. And he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. So this narrative turns once more to the scene of Joseph and his brothers, and in doing so returns to the central theme of the Joseph story here. You intended to harm me, do evil to me, but God intended it for good, to the saving of many lives. Here's the key. Behind all the events and human plans recounted in the story of Joseph lies the unchanging plan of God, this hand moving them. It is the same plan introduced from the very beginning of the book, where God looks out at what he has just created for man and sees that it is good. He pronounces his judgment that it is good. Through his dealings with the patriarchs and Joseph, God has continued to bring about his good plan, despite the decisions that they made, despite the almost nutty ideas that they had with respect to their wives or whatever it was, God's hand was guiding them. And eventually, as they matured, they began to understand this and place their faith in greater, greater amounts in the Lord himself and in his plan. So just to summarize here with time, we have verses 22 through 26. Here is the summary of Joseph's life and death. And let's read these verses here. Verse 22, chapter 50, Genesis. So Joseph dwelt in Egypt, he and his father's household, and Joseph lived 110 years. Verse 23, Joseph saw Ephraim's children to the third generation. The children of Machir, the son of Manasseh, were also brought up on Joseph's knees. Verse 24, and Joseph said to his brethren, I am dying, but God will surely visit you and bring you out of this land to the land which he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Then Joseph took an oath from the children of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here. Verse 26, so Joseph died, being 110 years old, and they embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. Remember the prophecy of Jacob, Joseph is a fruitful bough, just continually pouring forth blessing. So God had remained faithful to his purposes, and it is the point of this narrative to show that his people can continue to trust him and to believe that in all things God works for the good to those who love him, to have been called according to his purpose, Romans 8:28, that great verse. The last description of Joseph's dealings with his brothers really is the statement that he comforted them. NIV has, he reassured them and spoke kindly to them. So even though he's the second youngest, he's effectively the patriarch here that is blessing them and carrying this case of reassurance to them. Again, it's difficult not to see in this picture of Joseph and his brothers a foreshadowing of the future community of the sons of Israel in exile, awaiting their return to the promised land. Even in exile, they never forgot these promises and awaited the return. To the same community, the call went out by the prophet Isaiah to comfort. Comfort my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem. She has received from the Lord's hand double for all of her sins. So with God, and thankfully, we have forgiveness of sins, that remembrance of evil is put away forever, and God keeps his promises. Even when the situation looks bleak, he will always keep his promises. Just a quick summary of the application in Genesis. You've seen this before, certainly. It is important to keep in mind that Genesis is a book that Moses is writing to the Exodus Jews, the children of Israel, to remind them of where they came from, and that it is God who has separated a people to himself, the Israelites, the apple of his eye. So without further time spent, given where we are right now, 7:31, let's play this video from the Bible Project.
Yeah, Ray, if you want, I can try to share it for you. Is it,
what is it?
It's not playing right now.
Do you want to do that yourself, Neil?
Yeah, I think I can try to do it.
Sure.
And share it.
Sure. This is the... So Bible Project Genesis 12 through 50. So who can see this video? Can the people on Zoom see it?
Well, it doesn't look like anything's playing. We see your screen, but I didn't see anything start to play. But anyway.
So it's embedded in my PowerPoint presentation, so I can see it on my screen.
We never saw the video play, but that's okay. I mean, I found it.
Can you play it for everybody? Okay.
Just give me a second.
Sure, no problem. Thank you for your help.
Yeah, give me a second. I just want to make sure I got the right thing. So it's the Bible, it's BibleProject.com.
I would just put in Bible Project Genesis 12 through 50.
Okay, and you have it off of YouTube?
Yeah, the official title is Overview : Genesis 12, the number 12-50. And I just found it on YouTube.
Sorry, give me a second. I think I've
Sure, no problem. Take your time. We've got a good 15 minutes here before I get the axe. Or the old vaudeville hook where they drag me away.
First video we saw of chapter 1. Okay, I did find it. So I'm about
Perfect.
To share it.
Great, thank you.
Can you stop your sharing, please?
Sure. Okay. We can do this.
The Book of Genesis. In the first video, we saw how chapters 1 through 11 set up the basic storyline of the Bible. God has created all things, and he makes humans in his image to rule the world on his behalf. The humans choose sin and rebellion, and so the world spins out of control into violence and death, all leading up to the rebellion and scattering of the people in Babylon. And so the big question is, what is God going to do to rescue and redeem his world? Well, out of that scattering at Babylon, the author traces a genealogy of just one family that leads eventually to a man named Abram, later known as Abraham. And God's promise to Abraham at the beginning of chapter 12 opens up a whole new movement in the story. God calls Abraham to leave his home and go to the land of Canaan, which God says will become his one day. And in that land, God promises to make Abraham into a great nation, to make his name great, and to bless him. Now, these promises are connected back to earlier parts of the book. So Babylon had arrogantly tried to make a great name for itself, and that didn't go over very well. But God, in his generosity, is going to bestow a great name on this no-name guy, Abraham. And God's blessing of Abraham echoes all the way back to that original blessing God gave humanity in the beginning. So the question is, why is God going to bless Abraham and his family? And the last line of God's promise makes this clear. So that all the families of the earth will find God's blessing in you. Now, this is key for understanding the whole rest of the biblical story. God's plan is to rescue and bless his rebellious world through Abraham's family. And this is why the whole rest of the Old Testament story is just going to focus on this one family, eventually called the people of Israel. This is also why Israel will later be called a kingdom of priests at Mount Sinai. God wants to use them to show all of the other nations what he's like. And ultimately, this is the promise that gets picked up by the later biblical prophets and poets who say that its fulfillment will come through Israel's messianic king, whose reign will bring justice and peace to all of the nations. Now, at this point of the story, none of that's clear. You just have to keep reading and watch the promise develop. And so the rest of the book focuses on Abraham and his family. First, Abraham himself, then his son Isaac, and then his son Jacob, and then Jacob's 12 sons. And the stories about each generation, they're united by two main themes. So first, each generation of Abraham's family is marked by repeated failure. They just keep making really bad decisions that mess up their lives and that put God's promise in jeopardy. However, God remains faithful to them. He keeps rescuing them from themselves and reaffirming his commitment to bless them and bless the nations through them despite their failings. So the Abraham stories. God had promised Abraham a huge family, but on two different occasions, he's afraid for his life because other men are attracted to his wife, and so he denies that he's even married to her, which creates, of course, all of these problems. And not only that, Abraham and his wife Sarah, they can't have children, and so Sarah arranges for Abraham to sleep with one of their servant girls, which also creates all of these problems in the family. But each time, God bails Abraham out. And in chapters 15 and 17, God even formalizes his promise to Abraham with an official commitment called a covenant. This is a classic scene. God invites Abraham to look up at the night stars and to count them. And he says, "That's how numerous your family is going to be." And despite all of the odds, having no kids and no way to have any at the moment, Abraham looks up in the sky and simply trusts God's promise. And God responds by entering into a covenant with Abraham, promising that he will become a father of many nations, that God's blessing may come to the whole world. God asks Abraham to mark his family with a sign of the covenant, circumcision of all the male boys in the family. This is a symbol to remind them that the fruitfulness of their family is a gift from God. And so Abraham has lots of kids eventually, and he dies at a good old age. Now, the Jacob stories play out these themes even more dramatically. From birth, Jacob lives up to the meaning of his name, which is deceiver. He cheats his brother Esau out of his inheritance and blessing, and he does it by deceiving his old blind father, no less, and then he just takes off. He goes on to take four wives, even though he really only loves one, Rachel, and this creates all of these rivalries in the family. The only thing that humbles Jacob is being deceived by his uncle Laban, who cheats him out of years of his life. The tables have finally turned. And so it's a humbled Jacob that returns to his homeland. And in a very strange story, Jacob ends up wrestling with God as he demands that God bless him. Some things never really change, do they? However, God honors his determination, and he passes Abraham's blessing on to him. And he renames Jacob as Israel, which means wrestles with God. Now, it's this last part of the book, the story of Jacob's sons, where all the themes come to a head. Jacob loves his second to youngest son, Joseph, more than any of the others, and he gives him this special jacket. And the 10 older sons come to hate Joseph, and so they kidnap him, and they plan to kill him, but instead they decide to just sell him into slavery in Egypt, where he ends up in prison. Talk about family failure. But God is with Joseph, and he orchestrates Joseph's release from prison, and Pharaoh ends up elevating Joseph to second in command over all of Egypt. And so Joseph saves the nation of Egypt during a famine, and he also ends up saving his brothers and his family from starving to death. And so once again, we can see the folly and the sin of Abraham's family is met with God's faithfulness, who subverts even the evil of the brothers into an occasion to save life. And this is actually what Joseph says right near the end of the book. He says to his brothers, "You all planned this for evil, but God planned it for good to save many lives." Now, these words are strategically placed at the end of the book because they summarize not only the story of Joseph and his brothers, but the book as a whole. From Genesis 3 onward, humans keep acting selfishly and doing evil, but this God is not going to leave his world to its own devices. He remains faithful and determined to bless people despite their failures. You can see this especially in how that mysterious promise about the descendant of the woman gets developed throughout the book. So remember, Genesis 3, God promised that this wounded victor would come and crush the snake and defeat evil at its source. And the author then connects this promise directly to the line of Abraham. This is a part of how God's going to bring his blessing to the nations. Now, from Abraham, this promise gets connected to Judah, the fourth son of Jacob, and this is how. In an extremely important poem in chapter 49, an aging Jacob, he's on his deathbed, he wants to bless his 12 sons. And when he comes to Judah, Jacob predicts that Judah will become the tribe of Israel's royal leaders, and that one day a king will come who will command the obedience of all the nations and fulfill God's promise to restore the garden blessing to all of the world. And then after this, Jacob dies. And later, Joseph dies too. And the growing family remains in Egypt. And so the book of Genesis ends with all of these future hopes and promises left hanging and undeveloped. And it forces you to turn the page to see how it's all going to turn out. But for now, that's the book of Genesis.
So we can conclude the book here and conclude our study. And thanks for your attention.
Thank you, Ray. Such a nice study. Congratulations, everyone. We'll be putting a certificate in the mail for you for completing this study of Genesis with us over the last year and a half, I think. And I think everybody's passed the course pretty well. And appreciate your being willing to come along and learn every week about how the God's in the beginning plan.
Will be examined?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
It'll be a quick exam. But we want to turn the page now and learn how the rest of the story begins. As the animator said, we'll go to Exodus after this. Lord willing.